Hey, ladies and gentlemen, it's Dr. Smith. I'm here today to discuss Edmund Burke and his political philosophy, just to give you a sense of some of the stuff that I looked at to help me build my lecture, and that if you're interested, you can go to. The Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy is a solid article on Burke by Ian Harris. Ian Harris, pretty good article, nice summation. I also, of course, I have my copy of the, his most famous work is Reflections on the Revolution in France. I have a Penguin Books edition, which has an 80-page introduction Connor Cruz O'Brien. I apologize. That's really in-depth, really intense, wonderful essay there. I also went through a lot of my different things from my reader, the Portable Edmund Burke, edited by Isaac Kramnik, and some of the essays at the beginning of the Cambridge text in History of Political Thought, Burke's pre-revolutionary writings by, which is edited by Ian Harris, also has some wonderful introductory essay material. So those are some of the sources I relied on to make sure I was hitting high points here, and that if you're interested, you can go check out yourself. Okay, guys. Edmund Burke. Edmund Burke is going to be a near-perfect reaction. Not reaction, that's not the way to put it. Like taking into account our friend Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and then comparing him to Edmund Burke, what's going to happen is we're going to see a very distinct split. And the split, in many ways, we can regard as the beginning of liberalism dividing into two fundamentally different camps. On the one camp, we have what's going to come to be known kind of generically. In the United States, we're prone to just say liberal, or liberalism for this camp, but ultimately progressive liberalism. The vision of liberalism that Rousseau has enunciated that focuses on the idea that human beings have the ability and the initiative and the right to transform polity, economy, and society kind of at will into whatever they want. This idea is basically going to motivate all sorts of great thinkers. It's going to be very important and inspiring, of course, Marxian thought. We'll get to that soon. But also thinkers at pretty much the entire scope of the left side of the liberal philosophy. On the other hand, we have Edmund Burke, and Burke is going to be the father of what we might think of as conservatism or conservative liberalism. He is going to emphasize a lot of the same fundamental underlying values as prior liberals, but he's also not... he's got some pretty significant differences, and those are going to stand out as clearly distinguishing him and his work from his predecessors. So let's just start kind of taking him apart piece by piece. There's a lot to get to. He's really interesting. I'm actually really always have enjoyed Burkean thought. And if you get the chance, by the way, if you've ever met Dr. Sheldon, Burke is one of his, he knows more about Burke. He probably talks more. Gosh, I'm a hillbilly. He probably could say more brilliant things about Burke in his sleep than I could in a month of Mondays. Like, he just really knows his Burke. So, right off the bat, let's start with Burke's assumption of what is this going to be his most kind of defining trait when it comes to understanding human beings. And that trait is going to be, simply put, it's going to be inequality. This is a major break from the thought and the theories and the philosophies of the other social contract theorists, who will argue, in essence, that the starting point, or one of the principal starting points for understanding human behavior, human politics, human ethics should be the assumption of human equality. Burke, on the other hand, argues that inequality is a natural element of human society, economy, and polity. And it's not just natural, it's essential if we want economy, society, and polity to function correctly. Now, first off, let's understand what he means by natural. Where does it come from? And he argues that inequality is a product of human passions at its root. Specifically, it emerges from the three passions that he's going to kind of talk about are sympathy, imitation, and ambition. Now, this is really important. By saying that humans are fundamentally sympathetic beings, he is echoing guys like Rousseau and Locke. He's denying the kind of strict egoism of Hobbes or some, shall we say, more melodramatic interpretations of Machiavelli. But what he's particularly arguing is that human beings naturally have a tendency to be to care about the suffering of other human beings. We care, we're empathetic, we're sympathetic. We feel to a degree what we believe they feel. And this is a fundamental driving characteristic of our nature. Another fundamental assumption is that we are imitative. Again, imitative meaning that this is just something that humans do. And I think that there's actually, this is a brilliant kind of observation by Burke. Human beings are imitative. We are primates, and primates are imitative, guys. A wonderful book by Frans de Waal, van der Waal, called The Ape and the Sushi Master. I believe that's what it's called. Basically is about like this whole fundamental characteristic of all primates, including humans, to learn an enormous proportion of what we can and will learn through the observation of other members of our species. We imitate. This is the source, or the genesis, if you will, of maybe not all of culture, certainly not in a linguistic species like our own, but arguably the bulk of culture is imitative. So human beings are fundamentally imitative creatures. And we are therefore prone to imitate those who we see as proper to imitate or worthy of imitation. Now this right here automatically is going to be, when you think about this as a passion, that's quite in contrast to the next passion, which is ambition. And ambition, Burke basically defines as the pleasure of excelling others. In other words, we want, if we go back to Aristotle, right? Aristotle is going to talk about things like honor, wealth, and power as being motivating human beings. I think what Burke would say is, in fact, those are merely just dimensions of our general desire, our general ambition, that we seek to have superiority. Now, here's the thing. Ambition is not intrinsically bad by any means. What Burke would argue is this is what compels human beings to the pursuit of improvement of institutions, of structures, of artifices, you name it. Like, all of the arts and sciences, ultimately, contrary to what Rousseau thinks, they're not signs of the degeneration of human beings. They're signs of our progress. They are indeed the mechanism of our continual improvement. And in the absence of ambition, we have a stultified, meaningless, empty kind of existence as human beings. This then kind of plays out in a kind of dance with our tendency towards imitation. Now, the gist of it is that basically in most of us, our ambition is limited. We are more prone to be imitative than we are ambitious. And you might call this like the teenage impulse. I don't know. Like it is, this is just like our general tendency as human beings is to be more prone to imitate than to try and create something new or to try and strike out as a leader. And for some of us, it is the opposite. We are prone to be more ambitious rather than imitative. We want to create or excel others in one or another way. And this is what leads to progress. This, combined with the fact that clearly we're all quite variant in terms of our actual skills and capabilities, leads to inequality. It is the emergence of inequality in society. The bulk of us end up being followers. And we contribute to society, and we find happiness and meaning in society, but we're not necessarily involved in the creation of anything essentially new and progressive, something that moves us forward. On the other hand, some few of us are critical in leading to that progress, Burke would say, of advancement. Now, it's a really interesting perspective. It also is kind of critical because it kind of helps us to understand the kind of linear tendency towards progress that we see over and over as a theme in Western thought, as opposed to Rousseau begins to see that linear progress as a kind of a decline, at least, that we have to then try and arrest and recover from, versus Burke. Burke is going to basically argue that the tendency towards progress is natural and will only get upset when we try to cheat, when we try to, in essence, progress faster through manipulating things. But I don't want to get ahead of myself. I'm sorry. That could be a problem. So there are implications of this inequality. There's a lot of stuff. One of the things is that Burke's going to argue that this means that we have a fundamentally, human beings have natural aristocracies. These natural aristocracies, we can pretty much figure out who they are because they are the people who are the landed, they are wealthy, they are powerful. They're the people who have access to the mechanisms of the state and the economy. And these are people who are particularly well suited towards and for, political leadership. And ultimately, this comes down to this concept, ultimately, of kind of liberty that we see all the way back to like Greek thought, right? The idea that if you look at the Greeks, Greek citizens in Greek democracies would typically be people who had to be able to serve in the military, which implied they had to be able to buy their own weapons. They had to be able to take time off from work to participate in politics, to participate in war. They had to engage in the process of politics in an active way, which implied liberty and implied leisure, right? You have to have the time and the income to dedicate yourself to education, to dedicate yourself a well-rounded liberal arts education. Think about that, the implication of liberal arts. The arts that are appropriate for someone who is free and also imply that you are free to actually pursue them. And so this idea is a very old one in Western thought. It's by no means a new kind of development. And Burke is going to say, basically, yeah, these people who are able to have the wealth which gives them leisure, who are the most appropriate to lead. Now, let me go on and say this. At the theoretical level, there's a lot of truth to this. The problem that will always come up with this is, of course, that's not always true. Yes, there is a leisure and a liberty that comes from wealth, but does that wealth necessarily imply that you are going to be a capable leader and equally importantly, an ethical leader? That's a dilemma, right? It's a real problem. But that criticism's already inherent in the thought of guys like Rousseau, so we're not going to dwell on it. On the other hand, what Burke is going to argue is that the weakest base for the leadership, the weakest base for a good political system is the normal people, the masses, call them the proletariat, call them the working class, the people who spend most of their time working and trying to make money to have the food they need, to keep a roof over their head. They don't have time for esoteric political and theoretical and philosophical kinds of thoughts. These are people who, insofar as they participate and think about politics, it tends to be imitative. They're not thinking through things in a complex way. They're the people who get online or honestly, and we know this. We know this to be true to a substantial degree. Think about how many people you know that their entire political understanding of the world is they sit down on the couch, plop, after a day's work or after whatever activities they are, and they watch 15 minutes to an hour and a half of TV talk shows and or news. And they absorb opinions from other people. Maybe that's probably the majority of human beings have at most that level of political savvy. And it's not because they're bad, and it's not because they're lazy. It's because they work for a living. It's because there are demands on their time. It is because they simply they haven't had the opportunity to have an intensive liberal education. They don't have the ability to maintain a deep, constant engagement with politics. And also, frankly, I think what Burke would say is they're not really inclined to. Most people don't care about politics that much. It's just not a priority. And if it's not a priority enough that you would invest your time and your energy into the study and the pursuit of politics, then you damn well shouldn't be in charge of political decision making. That's his argument, and there's some truth to it. The other thing that kind of leads Burke to down the path of emphasizing inequality that some authors talk about is his kind of ardent rejection of deism. Now, let me get one and say this, and I won't talk about it too much. I'm not an expert on it by any means, but Burke is not Roman Catholic. He is Irish, but he's not Roman Catholic. He, however, has family members who are Roman Catholic. Throughout his life, he'll be constantly kind of accused of being a crypto-Catholic, a hidden Catholic, but he seems to be pretty much just a member of the Church of England who accepts it pretty fervently. Six of one, half dozen the other. He's very sympathetic to Catholics and to, at different points in time, dissenting Protestants, so sometimes he raises his ire with them. But ultimately, what comes down to is he makes a strict separation between deists and other Christians of Britain, or other people who are Christian in Britain. And of course, atheists, he's going to eventually lump in with deists. So deism is an approach that basically argues that God creates the universe and sets it in motion, like a clock, if you will, and then does not interfere. It is an impersonal relationship that God has with the universe and in terms of its day-to-day action. What this means is that, for instance, human beings don't have a particularly personal relationship with God, no matter kind of what we think. And more importantly is, if you accept this, maybe not more importantly, but maybe more importantly in this moment, if you accept the tenets of deism, then you're arguing basically that God doesn't play favorites when it comes to salvation in any sense. In other words, when you're born Christian, it's kind of an accident. You could have just as easily been born another faith or no faith. And in point of fact, because God created the universe to be essentially fair from the beginning and to see it unfold in itself, God, the assumption is not going to bias salvation towards those of who quote unquote get it right in terms of articles of faith. That means that you basically can be a good person in any way, shape, or form, and don't have to have the right religion, and therefore, and still can be achieve salvation. Burke basically completely rejects this. Burke says, you know what? That's not true. That you have to be of the right religion, and that being of the right religion means that there is already built into the system an intrinsic unfairness. In other words, salvation being dependent on basically the inequality God is building into the system. Well, if we assume that God, being reasonable, builds on the same pattern over and over, if there's inequality in terms of who can and can't be saved, who will and won't go to heaven, why wouldn't we assume inequality is the standard in terms of access to wealth and power and social influence? And that's kind of another kind of the fundamental elements in here. So we've talked a lot already. Let's move on to something related. All of this is related. Think of it almost like a stew that kind of is all clumpy and lumpy and interactive. And we're just trying to get through this on the balance, as it were. So, an additional thing that's really critical to understanding Burkean thought is Burke, his reiteration of the essential centrality of the church and of tradition in laying the groundwork of any ethical political system and any value that we could regard as a civil value, including civil liberty. Now, why is this the case? Well, putting aside any intrinsic utility to the church itself, what is particularly important for those of us who are interested in Burkean thought is that church and tradition have the ability to allow us to engage in what we might think of as proper behavior. If you've ever read Confucian thought, the idea of li, of propriety, is actually quite analogous to Burkean notions. So basically what we do here is we say, well, there are two ways you can run a state. One is through coercion, right? You can tell people what they're going to do, and you can create an adequate threat of force that they obey you, and that's how things get done. That's how the system keeps from falling apart. So this is the kind of system that is what we might think of as essentially tyrannical, right? It's a system in which the only reason I obey the state is because if I don't, the punishment will be severe. On the other hand, Burke says, when we consider political systems that are not tyrannical, one of the things that makes them possible is that by and large, the people in those societies do not engage in unethical behavior. They restrain themselves. They respect superior-inferior relationships. They respect the social norms of their times. They respect the symbolic gestures that reiterate and allow imitation to be taught to young people of those social norms. They respect all these different traditions and ideals and values, and they embody them. They carry them out in practice with their behavioral choices. So in other words, the culture, including and critically the values and principles of the church, are what allow people to restrain their own behavior enough that the state largely acts, instead of as a coercive unit, it is principally an arbitrative unit, something that defends the people from external threats, defends them from particularly nasty people who ignore tradition, who ignore culture, who ignore the tenets of the church, but also it largely serves to then arbitrate disputes over basically the proper interpretation of those principles. Those are kind of the, that's kind of the role of the state in a well-functioning ethical state, according to Edmund Burke. Okay, makes sense, actually. That's a pretty brilliant thing. And again, the analogs of this to Confucian thought are very real. If you're interested in that, write me and I could get you some books to read on it. It's really interesting stuff. I've even thought about writing about it. I'm sure someone smarter than me already has. So this is also important because there is a correlation, says Burke, between the manners and culture and society that we see in any functioning polity and the proper institutions for that polity, right? So for a state to work right, for a state, or maybe what we should really be thinking of this as, is a more organic whole, a society slash state slash economy, there needs to be a proper correlation between the culture and the manners and the all the different elements of propriety and ethics that are indigenous to society and the culture, and the particular institutions at work. This is one of the reasons why Burke will be very skeptical of efforts to radically change our society, economy, or polity. In other words, to engage in this action that we call revolution. Revolution, as the term comes to be meant, especially with the emergence of the French Revolution, is this process by which human beings attempt to create essentially new socioeconomic and political relations all at once, like in one fell swoop. This radical transformation of society, economy, and polity. A very brilliant thinker named Theda Skocpol, I'm so sorry, writes quite a bit about that. It's quite interesting. If you're interested, she argues that these what she calls social revolutions, true revolutions, are actually quite rare. And she'll point to, for instance, the Russian Revolution, the French Revolution, the Iranian Revolution, and so forth as the examples of this. And this is going to be critical because she's going to argue, kind of like Burke, that the American Revolution isn't really a revolution at all. But we'll put a pin in that for a moment. So revolution, then, is this attempt of human beings to devise essentially a new way of living, to progress enormously in one fell sweep. And that has, that impulse is very understandable. I think even Burke kind of understands the impulse to want to do it, to progress. The problem with that is if we attempt to change too quickly, then what can the state change? What can we really alter? Well, we can only really alter quickly our institutions. And if we change our institutions quickly, then what's going to happen is that they're not going to match our traditions and our culture and our manners and so forth. And that's going to mean that we have to do one of two things. Either we have to scale back our institutional reform, or then we try to eliminate tradition. We eliminate culture. We eliminate rank. We eliminate propriety. We get rid of the old logic of inequality that guaranteed a stable society based on a lack of coercion, based on basically voluntary self-restraint. And that voluntary self-restraint is the core of personal liberty. So in our attempts to improve society and achieve greater goods, which include, of course, liberty, an expansion of liberty, if we try to change too quickly, we risk throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Because in trying to change the institutions radically, we have to change the traditions, we have to change propriety, which effectively means that we're going to have this kind of anarchy of tradition, this anarchy of propriety, until we can install a new one, which you might argue Burke basically kind of hints we can't just install a new one anyways. And in the end, what's going to happen is that we will revert. We will find ourselves in a tyranny every time. We will lose all of the progress gradually attained over decades and centuries in our culture, and we'll find ourselves under a brand new set of institutions that may or may not work very well, because there are limits on our ability to exercise foresight as human beings, and that these institutions are going to, in order to continue to function, they're going to have to be coercive. They're going to have to deprive us of personal liberty, and they're going to have to deprive us of a whole host of other goods, because liberty is only one of the values a state should be seeking to provide, I couldn't think of that word, St. Andrew, to its population. Now, this is why we can look at the American Revolution and see why Burke didn't regard it as fundamentally wrong. In fact, he supported parts of it, and contrast that to his understanding of the French Revolution. The French Revolution, Burke sees as eliminating, insofar as possible, inequality. It's one of its key words. Liberté, égalité, fraternité, right? Equality is the goal. It is not a Republican revolution like the American system, where the Americans, they did get rid of nobility, and they did get rid of things like corruption of the blood, and they created a secular state. But they did so in a way that guaranteed equality of the religions, allowed the religions to stay. And in fact, most political theorists would say they did it in a way that actually allowed them to prosper in a way they wouldn't have otherwise. The Americans did not fundamentally alter social relations. They didn't try to deprive the wealthy of their wealth or the powerful of their access to traditional sources of influence through the church or culture. The Americans basically, they created a system that simply used essentially the logics of British culture and ethics and institutions, made incremental changes, and that they were justifiable because the British government, the British Parliament, was refusing to guarantee those essential liberties and other goals and other benefits that had been always part of being English. They were failing to guarantee those to the Americans, so the Americans basically engaged in a secession movement, one that wasn't radical in the sense of being a true revolution. The French are going to try to eliminate nobility. They're going to step by step try to radically transform their economy. They're going to shift towards as democratic a system as they can. They're going to try to quote-unquote rationalize everything, which includes even at one point the host of efforts to try and undermine even the existence of religions. And ultimately what Burke is going to say is this is misguided, and it's going to lead to, he predicts rightly, that the French Revolution and other super duper radical revolutions like that are going to have a tendency to break down and all of their high-minded liberal ideals or eventually like Marxian ideals or what have you are going to kind of just fall to the wayside and be replaced by repressive, coercive politics, just to re-establish order in the world. Now, you can also argue that Burke misses a lot of the benefits that are going to emerge from the French Revolution, and that Burke underestimates the radicalness of the American Revolution. You can also say that Burke, in his concern for preserving the progress generated by the elites, sometimes fails to understand that progress can come in other ways. You know, the classic saying by Reverend King, justice delayed is justice denied. Burke, frankly, doesn't have a good answer to that. But what Burke does do is he gives us a wonderful, rich counterpoint to Rousseau and his vision of the general will as allowing the state to do whatever the people want. Not allowing the state, of the state reacting to whatever the people want, to doing, carrying out the essential will and interest of the people, lickety split. the inspiration, if you will, for the radicalness of the French Revolution. So it's not that Rousseau is right or wrong, and it's not that Burke is right or wrong. It's that we need to think of them, I would argue, as in a perpetual contest of ideas, in which Burke is best understood if we look at Rousseau as his critique. And Rousseau is best understood as we understand Burke as his critique. They're both flawed, they're both imperfect, but they both contribute so very much. And they frankly, together, prove that there's a real permanent tension if we want to achieve durable, ethical, political systems that are founded in individual liberty. And guys, that's it. Those are the broad strokes of Edmund Burke. I'm trying not to go too long on him. And I'll see you all in the next lecture.